If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Today Healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations of Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways Healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Today's guest is Heather Jones, Professor in Modern and Contemporary European History at University College London. Heather's new book, For King and Country, examines the role that the British monarchy played during the First World War and explores how the conflict shaped cultural attitudes to the royal family, both within Britain and across the empire. Heather was joined in conversation by BBC History Revealed staff writer Emma Slattery-Williams.
At the start of your book, you comment on how other biographies and work on George V and the British monarchy during the early 20th century have often bypassed the First World War. Why do you think this is?
I think that a lot of the biographies of monarchs tend to try and cover a very large time span and move obviously from their birth right through to their death. And I think the First World War is such a specialist area, and there's been so much new research that a lot of biographers tended to try to skirt through it quite quickly. The other thing was that actually in the post-war period, what the monarchy had been doing during the war, it really began to be forgotten. The focus was very much on how the monarchy commemorated the war rather than on its actual wartime work. So I think for biographers, there was a tendency maybe not to see the magnitude of what they'd done. And one of the other things was that some biographers who did cover the war, you know, in quite detailed chapters, I'm thinking of Harold Nicholson, for example, they tended to really focus on the political and the actual sort of the charitable war work and the welfare war work. It tended to get less attention because that was what people in the 1950s writing biographies were slightly less interested in that period.
So before the First World War, how were the British monarchy viewed?
Before the First World War, the British monarchy is seen as a very authoritative institution. So it's very much seen as a symbolic of the state, but also very, very symbolic in religious terms as well. And this is, before 1914, still quite a religious society. And there's sort of a sense of awe around the monarchy. It's very much a sense of awe and respect and a certain distance a certain admiring from afar. And there is a start to changing that with the reign of George V. He and Queen Mary do start doing things like visiting mines, going down a mine before the First World War, visiting miners' cottages. But really, that's very new when the war breaks out. That change has only just started. Really, before this, the Edwardian monarchy, the Victorian monarchy, it's very much the pinnacle of the British class system, and it's seen as something to be viewed and admired from afar by ordinary people.
Were there any private conversations between the royal cousins, so George V, Wilhelm of Germany, and Nicholas of Russia, to try and avert war?
There weren't private conversations as such. The Kaiser's brother was used as an emissary by Kaiser Wilhelm II in the weeks leading up to the war. He was in England. He spoke with the king, and he got the impression that Britain would remain neutral, erroneously, from that conversation. He sort of heard what he wanted to hear in that conversation, actually. And when we look at the three cousins, the communications in that period is all by letter or telegram. So you're not seeing a kind of personal meeting up or anything in that period. They're all in their own countries. Now, there had been periods before where royal diplomacy had been done in sort of meetings, events such as family weddings, the most important of which was the 1913 wedding of the Kaiser's daughter, where we do see the cousins coming together. There are conversations about military issues, foreign policy issues, but all in the British case, with the approval and in a way collusion of the Foreign Office. So really, the period just before the war, communication is really open to error, to confusion, and they aren't all put in the same room to kind of hammer it out at all. And in many cases, they have very different amounts of power. If we think of the state structures in Britain, George V's power and influence operates really differently to that of the autocratic Tsar or of Kaiser Wilhelm, who has a lot more freedom in military areas.
So when it came to visiting the front, did George visit his troops very often?
King George V visited the front on six occasions during the war. He really made a huge effort to actually be present and see his troops. He inspected every division before they went to the front. He would go down and inspect those units while they were still in Britain. And then when troops were at the front, he would travel around in a car and try and see as many of the men as he could, or have them see him when they were lined up along the roadside. He also went into quite forward areas to try and meet troops. And just to kind of show that he was interested in their welfare, he was trying to be supportive. Some of these visits were very unusual. In the 1914 visit, which was a real break with precedent, because a British monarch was actually not supposed to lead his men in war, according to a convention that went back to the 18th century, George V sort of went to France to see what was happening and tried to see virtually all of the BEF, the British Expeditionary Force, in the field in 1914. So that was quite an unusual break with precedent and presence on the battlefield, if you like, for a British monarch in modern times. And then the 1918, first visit of 1918, when George V goes at very short notice upon news of the German spring offensive beginning. This is a huge German offensive against the British lines. It pushes British troops back very, very, very dramatically. They're basically in headlong retreat. George V, within hours, announces he's going to go to the front to be with his armies in that moment of real peril. And that's a very unusual trip as well, because actually, the commander-in-chief in the field has very little time to prepare for it. And in fact, is too busy to really see the king. And the king doesn't particularly want to see him either. He's going to be with the troops themselves. And he spends most of that visit in 1918 visiting hospitals, visiting the wounded, who are, and in some cases, men who've literally just come from the front lines, because all the dressing stations and hospitals have been pushed back as a result of the retreat. So George V's arriving in a very chaotic situation. He even sees people being operated on. It's quite an unusual visit again for a British monarch. This is a very unique situation for a British monarch in the 20th century, and it is appreciated by the troops. He's turning up in locations where they wouldn't have expected to see him, and expressing his support for them.
Do we know what they thought of him then, and what the reaction was back home of the king going to the front?
Well, the reaction back home is very much coloured by what one might call royalist propaganda in the newspapers, and a very strong sense of kind of monarchist patriotism amongst the middle classes. But we do know that amongst, for example, munitions workers, there's a real sense of positivity around both the king and queen and their children, because of the number of munitions factories they have visited. And this wasn't a particularly safe thing to do. In some cases, we have photographs of George V standing surrounded by shells. As we know at the time, munitions were not always reliable. Some were faulty. There are shell explosions where munitions workers are killed. And there was some consternation actually amongst officials when they saw some of these images of the king surrounded by explosives. So munitions workers at home were very positive about the royal visits to the front as well. They saw them in similar terms to the king's interest in workers and the working classes. And he was developing this reputation for himself during the war as a king who wanted to be supportive of workers. He was referred to as a kind of a working man at one point in some of the newspapers, which is quite a surprising term. It's very associated with socialism. And they're referring to the monarch as a kind of working man who's putting in a 10-hour day, 14-hour day, at his job. The troops at the front, the reactions were more mixed. What we see in the initial phases of the war is surprise at the king coming and a kind of appreciation at him coming as well. A slight level of bemusement. Sort of, what is the king doing here in some of the 1914 reports? And a sense also of the king being associated with home. This idea that actually seeing the king really reminds these men of their homes. In many homes in the period, a picture of the king and queen would actually hang in the house. Certainly the image of the king and queen was to be found in all public buildings. And so a sense of kind of familiarity and missing home, actually, a kind of homesickness sometimes comes out. Later in the war, we do get a sense of actual, in some cases, some negative reactions. Soldiers who are just fed up and too exhausted to really care when they see the king's car go past. Soldiers who, in some cases, grumble that actually, you know, they feel like they are not being prioritised. And we find there's an interesting memo that refers to the fact that for later visits by 1918, they want the king to talk to the men first and not the officers, because those advising the monarchy have become aware that actually there is this grumbling developing. And there is a, in 1917, there is a kind of moment where the reactions are more mixed. By 1918, again, the end of the war, reactions are very positive. And I think the Ludendorff offensive moment is actually a really key one when the king does go out in such remarkable circumstances and is present at a moment of danger. Because if Britain had lost the war at that point, the British king would have been associated with defeat. It was a big political risk to take to go out at that point. And be present. And by the end of the war, the king, after the armistice, goes to visit the battlefields again and see the men who are awaiting demobilisation, and again to kind of congratulate them on their war sacrifices. So there is a real sense, I think, of kind of 1917 as being this moment of wobble and mixed reactions. By 1918, it's kind of come full circle, and again, there's a sense of the king as somebody who actually, who's really genuinely interested in what's happening to his troops, and who is sort of above politics. He certainly doesn't get the negative reaction that, say, certain politicians get by the middle of the war.
I believe that there were a few near misses with the king when he was at the front. Could you tell us a bit about those?
Yes, it's interesting that in some cases, the places that the king was going to were places that were dangerous. I mean, this is not something one would maybe necessarily expect. Obviously, he has a police security detail with him, but there are real concerns. Some of the areas he visits are shelled immediately afterwards, and there's a sense that actually the Germans may actually be trying to target him. In one occasion, he goes to Bayeul, and it's shelled very soon after he leaves. In other cases, he turns up at places that were shelled the night before. So there is a sense of concern about that. There's also an occasion where he's in a communication trench with Frederick Ponsonby, the keeper of the Privy Purse, and shells pass overhead and land not far from that trench. And that again is a moment of real concern for advisers. Advisers are by as the war goes on, they really beef up his police detail going to France. They make new measures for rapid evacuation of the king should an offensive breakout. They're taking this very seriously. But ultimately, the king himself and also his son, the Prince of Wales, who is a staff officer, are both very keen to not be seen as just staying at far behind the lines at a 30 kilometres distance away from any danger. The king is never in the front line. Okay, he never is allowed to go that far forward. And his son, the Prince of Wales, does sneak into the front line on several occasions and really, you know, sort of is very popular with the troops who know he's doing this of his own choice as a staff officer in the role he had. He actually didn't need to go to these locations, and he constantly tries to get to the very front or visit areas that are being heavily shelled. The king himself doesn't get to the front line, but again pushes those boundaries and is visiting towns in what one would describe as the kind of rear area of the front, which are places of danger. And I was surprised to find that. I was surprised to find he was allowed to go to those locations and be present in that way. He also observes the starts of offensives through field glasses from high positions, hills, locations like that. So he's much more of a battlefield presence, if you like, than one might initially expect.
The king was commander-in-chief symbolically. Did he have any say on military strategy, or did he ever give an opinion?
So in the tradition of the 20th century monarchy, the king is commander-in-chief but delegates that power and decision making to the commander in chief in the field. So George V was commander in chief of the British armies, but the commander in chief in the field was the one making all of the military decisions. And for most of the war, that is Sir Douglas Haig. Now, Haig is very close to the king, and they write constantly to each other. Haig sends his diaries to the king for the king to read them as soon as he's finished writing them, which is a remarkable act of kind of personal exposure, if you like, about your decision making, your daily life at the front, etc., to the monarch. And it's a very close relationship. So there is an element of influence there. Now, obviously, the armies themselves are supposed, the commander-in-chief in the field and the decision-making in the armies is meant to be being controlled by the government, the British government and the Prime Minister. But there is a space there for royal influence. So it's not the case that King George V is directly giving military decisions or ordering particular strategic decisions, but he is giving his opinion on them and giving it quite strongly. And in some places, his opinion is weighed up by cabinet, and it is the opinion that they go with. In other cases, it is clear that Haig appeals to the king when a decision is made that Haig doesn't like, in order that the king will then use influence with the government in order to see if the government will revisit that decision. So it's not direct control, but there certainly is a lot more influence and behind the scenes involvement than perhaps might at first appear. This is not a symbolic figurehead role in the First World War. George V is a much more politically active king. The monarchy has evolved across the 20th century. At this point, it still has quite a lot of actual political influence and involvement. If one thinks of the Irish context as well, King George V's involvement in the Home Rule Buckingham Palace Conference in 1914 in an attempt to bring divisions in Ireland to an end. There's very direct political interventions in some cases by George V throughout his reign. And in the case of military commanders, certainly there is royal royal influence going on. And it is affecting some of the decision-making process. In particular, the fact that the king backs Sir Douglas Haig right to the end of the war as the commander-in-chief in the field and does not want him replaced with anybody else is a really big factor in Haig retaining that role. The Prime Minister by 1918, at the latest, has lost faith in Haig, and really would like to get rid of him and replace him. And the king is a key factor in why that doesn't happen.
Douglas Haig was quite a controversial figure, wasn't he? He was blamed by some for the great loss of life at the Somme. So did that close relationship affect the king's reputation?
It's very interesting to sort of look at Sir Douglas Haig. In fact, Sir Douglas Haig's reputation is very strong until his death in the late 1920s. And his funeral is attended by hundreds of thousands of people. So he's actually a very popular commander. Our modern view of him is as kind of the butcher of the First World War. That's a very common popular view. That view really comes in the 1960s, actually. And it's a much later view. So actually, King George V is not damaged in public eyes by his association with Sir Douglas Haig. What's interesting is that the view around the First World War is a sort of a pointless war, a futile war, a war that was too costly in British lives to have been worth fighting. That view starts to come in the 1930s with key books being published, and one thinks of Vera Brittain's book Testament of Youth, and thinks of what's called the kind of literature of disenchantment, as these memoirs, these very anti-war memoirs, start to appear in that period in Britain, and they start to affect the public view of the war. It takes time, and George V is actually dead by the time that big shift in mood starts to happen towards the second half of the 1930s. So he really escapes any kind of opprobrium from his association with Sir Douglas Haig. One also has to remember, his role in these military decision-making processes is not known to the general public. And much of this is operating through systems of kind of what we would understand sort of old-fashioned patronage, jockeying for royal influence at court, military hierarchies, which would have been not known to the ordinary soldier at the front or the ordinary person on the street in Britain at the time. So royal influence is something that is behind the scenes.
What was Queen Mary's role during this time? What was she doing back home?
Queen Mary in the First World War is immensely popular. She's actually quite a shy personality. So there is this strange reality of quite a shy woman who acts very formally in public as a way almost of kind of compensating for that. And the public really respond to her well. I mean, it's a sort of something of a paradox, because unlike the king, who spends the war dressed in uniform, very much, you know, taking on a war effort role, she does lots of war work too, but she still also acts very much dresses as in her pre-war style. She doesn't particularly dress down for going to munitions factories or anything. So there's an interesting kind of public response of her to her reaching out, which is seen as very dignified. She's seen as a very dignified figure, and you know, always with her parasol, always asking lots of questions. She's a very inquisitive mind. And when she visits the front, which she does in 1917, she asks lots and lots of questions. When she visits munitions factories, she asks lots and lots of questions. She talks to people, she engages with them. And so she quickly gains this kind of reputation of sort of mother of the nation in many ways. Someone who is seen as very sort of dignified, respectable, dependable, and again as an important support to the king. So that's also very much seen how she's portrayed in her role, a maternal figure. And you have to remember, Britain in this war is very disorientated. This was not the type of war anyone expected to wage. Trench warfare seems like some kind of Armageddon, really. I mean, if we think of war before 1914, it was wars of movement. It was what we call cabinet warfare. It was fast. It didn't involve huge numbers of troops, and it was often in the colonial sphere. To suddenly see a huge war of trenches, industrialized war landscape across France and Belgium, countries many British middle class people would have visited on their holidays in this period as the tourist industry opened up, really was quite a shock. Many people would have gone to the beaches of northern France. They were very accessible from London by train. You could get there within a matter of kind of 6 to 8 hours, actually. It was really, really well networked in to the London tourist industry. So this shock, this disorientation, this sense of calamity and the sense of worry meant that you know, Queen Mary was a very reassuring figure, because she looked exactly as she'd always looked. She behaved exactly as she'd always behaved. She made people feel that there was a kind of steadiness there, and that while the world had been thrown into turmoil, here was this rock at the centre of the British monarchy that wasn't changing, that was a kind of maternal figure people could turn to. She's also very involved in charitable work, and this goes down extremely well. She's very proactive from the start of the war in setting up the Queen Mary Needlework Guild, which is builds on an older needlework organisation she had already. She's very quick to reach out to labour women and make quite close friendships with some of them, like Mary MacArthur. Very, very interested in the plight of the working classes in Britain during the war, and visits innumerable hospitals and talks to the wounded in those hospitals as well. So her actual war work is again very important in creating this idea of a monarchy that cares, a monarchy that is interested, a monarchy that is giving up its own luxuries. They're not involved in any kind of major social entertainments. They're all cancelled. They're all stopped. They don't go to the theatre during the war. They they give up all luxurious foods, pastry is stopped, cake, all these things are sort of barred from the royal palaces, alcohol as well, famously given up. So there's a sense of Queen Mary in that sense as well, sort of sacrificing with the king for the nation, which again is very positive. Then the other two aspects of her image that matter, she's a very religious woman. And this, again, gives her a popular appeal in a war setting where much of the public is actually turning to religion on the home front in this moment of fear. And it's quite a religious society. So she's seen as very, again, someone who has a kind of, dignity again and integrity as a result of that to that audience. And again, she's a mother. And at the end of the day, that is probably the strongest thing that she brings to the image of the monarchy, because she has two sons who are seen as serving in the war. Prince Albert, who is in the Navy, who serves at the Battle of Jutland at real risk. I mean, you know, you're on board a ship, you can be sunk. And at the Western Front, her oldest son, the Prince of Wales, is serving as a staff officer. And people know from what soldiers are telling them and what they're writing home and what's being published in the newspapers from soldiers' letters that the Prince of Wales is also putting himself in danger. So the sense of Queen Mary as a mother is very important. And we have accounts of other mothers on the home front meeting at her at events and saying, "You're a mother too. You understand this. You get this. You understand how worried I am about my son." And that's a really important bridge between the monarchy and ordinary people in this total war situation.
Queen Mary was the daughter of a German noble, and the British family had a lot of German connections. The king changed their name from Saxe-Coburg and Gotha to Windsor. How aware were the British public of the German connections, and did it affect the royal family's popularity?
So when I looked into the German connections of the royal family during the war, I was expecting to really find that, you know, from the start of the war, this was like a major issue for the public. And this was something that would have created anti-monarchist sentiment. I mean, if we look at the case of Russia, being of German origin really damns the Tsarina Alexandra. She's hated for it. And it's a big factor in leading up to the Russian Revolution, actually. If we look at the British context, the press is largely very muted on this. There's a couple of very radical left-wing newspapers that try to raise the issue of the monarchy's German connections in the first months of the war, and their circulation really dwindles. And this line of approach doesn't work. It doesn't attract public support. There's a kind of silence around the monarchy's German connections for much of the first phase of the war. And it's really only when we get to 1917 and the Russian Revolution that suddenly there is a public debate about the monarchy's German links. And that does start to appear in the press. And that does start to appear as something that people are now getting concerned about. And that's linked to war weariness, to a sense of suspicion of spies and of conspiracy theories, which start to really appear in this point in the war. And so this idea that maybe there's Germans within who are weakening the British war effort. And so it's actually something, it's actually a late war phenomenon. And so looking at that and the response to it, the fact that in response to that 1917 moment, the king then changes the name of the dynasty, made me start to think, well, why isn't there this concern about their German connections earlier? And I think part of it is that George V and Queen Mary do a very good job of espousing and projecting British patriotism. You know, they really are in some ways just emphasizing that they kind of symbolize the British people of Britain and the Empire at war. But also that's kind of projected onto them as well, because people, when the war breaks out, there's this big romantic kind of rush to the colors. There's a big romanticization of war. There's a sense of unity that suddenly appears in August and September 1914, and a real awareness of the danger of war. People aren't under illusions that this war is going to cost mass casualties. Those casualties start right from the very first weeks of the conflict. But there is a sort of home front narrative of that this is about glory, and as part of that, that has to be, a figurehead is in a way needed for that. So that the royals themselves almost get sucked into the role of being symbolic of Britishness and Britain as well, because that is what is needed in that moment, and people project that onto them. And so you really do see that nobody really wants to talk about their Germanness in that phase of the war, or any links they might have to Germany. And so it's actually a late war phenomenon. Now, what is important is that actually behind the scenes, obviously, at a personal level, the royals have very close connections to people who are living in Germany who are their relatives. So if we think of Queen Mary, one of her closest correspondents is a very dear elderly aunt who is living in Germany. And Queen Mary continues to write to her. In some cases, we know, for example, other members of the royal family, Queen Alexandra, who's the king's mother, continues to write to her German relatives too. So there is communication that does continue through intermediaries during the war, but there is no sense for the royal couple that they're anything other than British. And the king is very upset in 1917 when people start in this conspiracy kind of moment of the war, rumours start to spread that he's an alien. The famous quote, he says, "I'm damned if I'm an alien." He's really, really upset about that. And there's a sense of shock that anyone would question their Britishness, because their own identity, their own self-identity, is very much as being a British dynasty that has some German and other groups in its ancestry and in its continental relationships.
Do we know whose idea it was to change the royal house's name?
Lord Stanfordham, the king's private secretary, is key to the decision to change the name of the dynasty from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor in 1917. But then there's a coterie of advisors who all get involved in this and are all suggesting different potential names and what might be a good idea. At one point, the name Stuart is sort of bandied about, and then that's seen as unlucky. It didn't end so well. So there's quite interesting all these different names, and Stanfordham is the one who settles on Windsor, which is very effective. But the name change in some ways also comes preemptively. And one of the things I argue in the book is it's quite important to note that this debate around the moment of the Russian Revolution in February 1917, the first Russian Revolution, the Bolshevik one follows in October, that discussion around revolution and overthrowing monarchies that suddenly breaks out as a result of that moment. The British press is still very respectful of the British monarchy when they're discussing all of these continental events. And they actually take a lot of pains to really try and distinguish a constitutional British monarchical tradition, which they say is unique and different, from the kind of German or Russian versions, which they say are tyrannical and autocratic. And from the start of the war, even, they've been saying, the Kaiser's type of kingship is utterly un-British, utterly different to what we have, completely different model. We're going to war with it because it's tyrannical, it's oppressive, it's evil. It's nothing like our British constitutional democratic version. And so I think some of the name change is actually happens in advance of any kind of big public opinion change against the monarchy. They cut that off before it even happens with the name change. You get a sense that ordinary people aren't actually that concerned about the monarchy's Germanness, that it's really coming in the spring of 1917 from coming from socialist and fringe radical left wing magazines and newspapers, and also from some parts of the British middle classes, if you like, the intelligentsia. But the bulk of the ordinary munitions workers, you don't find many references there when they're talking about the monarchy to anything other than sort of excitement at royals coming to visit the factories. Or, a genuine interest in how new this is, that they're actually going to get to see the royals in person.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Bye. And so you do get a sense at court of huge fears that British workers might rise up and overthrow the monarchy, that they might arrest them and throw them into prison, that the police might not stay loyal, and these are really extreme fears in the context of 1918.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Spring is a time of renewal. So why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
So you mentioned the Russian Revolution there. Is it true that King George was one of the forces behind withdrawing Britain's offer of asylum to the family of Tsar Nicholas?
King George V is the decision maker who ultimately withdraws the offer of asylum to the Romanovs, to Tsar Nicholas II and his family. The British government had made that offer. It had been sent out. And so here we have this example of what I was talking about, this kind of royal influence behind the scenes, where it's actually the king who and his private secretary who request for that decision to be revisited and rethought, and make lots of arguments about why it should be withdrawn. They're very concerned about the unpopularity of the Tsar and the Tsarina in Britain. They are seen as very autocratic. They weren't popular even before 1914. They had very negative connotations. And during the war, continental monarchies have kind of been divided into two groups. Those that have kind of continued to be seen as autocratic or removed from their peoples, and those that are seen as sort of really taking on kind of the war sacrifice of the ordinary people. So the Belgian monarchy is incredibly popular in Britain during the war. The Italian monarchy is very popular. Both of those have monarchs who are, go to the front, spend lots of time with their troops. In the Belgian case, actually command, and so they're seen as very popular. In the case of the Tsar and Tsarina, they have had such negative pre-war press. Russia is seen as very oppressive of its ordinary peasant class and workers. And their reputation doesn't really recover from that, even though the Tsar and the Tsarina both make really big efforts to try and get involved in the war effort in their countries. The Tsarina takes up nursing. The Tsar goes to the front and takes up a command role. But none of that changes the view of the British public. So, in a nutshell, what we see is George V starting to get concerned about what will public opinion think of him if the Tsar and Tsarina come to Britain. And there is, there have been other royal refugees during the war. They've gone to places like Switzerland. They've all been fine. So in this revolutionary moment, which is a liberal revolution in Russia at this point, not a Bolshevik one, in the spring of 1917, when George V is making this using this influence and making this request for this decision to be rescinded, this decision of asylum to be rescinded. In this period, there's no way that George V could have known that this revolution was going to turn Bolshevik, that in fact the Tsar and the Tsarina wouldn't be able to go anywhere else, that in fact this decision has such portentous consequences for them. And so he ultimately does make that call for them for the Foreign Office and the government to withdraw that offer of asylum, which they then do, which is very revealing of royal influence. And they refer to how the arrival of the Russian royals would embarrass the royal family, and where would they live, and they might. I think there's a fear also they might eclipse the British royal family as well. And so there's evidence there of just how important the monarchy is in decision making, but also I think of the benefit of hindsight. At that point, the Russian Revolution was forming a liberal constitutional state, expected to become a republic. But it's not very clear that they're going to kill the Romanov family at all at that point. Later on, I think George V bitterly regretted that decision, and from all accounts, made extreme efforts to try and offer asylum to other royals later on who required it. And if one thinks of the Duke of Edinburgh's family, the late Duke of Edinburgh's family being evacuated from Greece by royal request on a British warship. One thinks of the evacuation of the Tsar's mother, the Tsar's sister coming to the UK after the war. So I think there is a sense of regret around that decision afterwards, once they realise, what has actually happened to the Russian royal family.
Do we have any sense of how rattled they were by the overthrow of other monarchies like Russia and later Germany and the Austria-Hungary Empire, or did they back themselves to survive?
What's very interesting during the war is the British royal family are more worried about their own survival and underestimate the chances of it as well than perhaps they needed to be. The British monarchy is in many ways very successful during the war in bolstering its popularity and in associating itself with war sacrifice and as a symbol of kind of patriotic symbol of both the island of Britain and the UK and the empire. If one looks at the 1918-1919 moment, it is a very dangerous moment, but actually victorious allied monarchies in the West, They do survive it. The Belgian monarchy, the Italian monarchy, and those are the monarchies that kind of follow the most similar model, wartime model to the British one. But the royals themselves are incredibly shocked by what happens with the overthrow of the Russian regime, with the abdication of the Tsar. They're actually quite pleased about the end of the German dynasty in 1918, the German Revolution and the declaration of a German Republic. So there is a sense there of that Wilhelm II has got his just desserts. The king writes some quite powerful things in his diary about how Wilhelm has caused the war and, you know, it has caused the most barbaric war in history and basically kind of the general gist of it is that Wilhelm II deserves everything he gets. With the Austro-Hungarian case, the British government's policy had changed towards the end of the war to trying to promote the breakup of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and to promote nation states that would be friendly to Britain in its aftermath. So again, government policy has changed. And again, the view of the monarchy is quite ambiguous as to whether, in terms of any pity for members of the Austro-Hungarian dynasty, I think there's a certain sense, again, of that they kind of got their just desserts. So there's kind of a mixed view on revolutions. But what happens with the case of Russia is a tremendous shock because it turns Bolshevik, because it becomes a socialist revolution, because it sends out this message that monarchy is incompatible with workers' welfare and workers' rights. And that's something that the British monarchy is really terrified by. And so you do get a sense at court of huge fears that British workers might rise up and overthrow the monarchy, that they might arrest them and throw them into prison, that the police might not stay loyal. And these are really extreme fears in the context of 1918, where there's really no evidence that there is this huge groundswell of anti-monarchical hatred amongst the mass of the British population. Even the slightest things, such as graffiti saying, you know, down with kings or something on a train can trigger, you know, a court memo of an analysis and discussion and fear that this is a portent for revolution tomorrow. So I think they do get a kind of sense of a mass scare, a kind of fear of reds under the beds almost kind of thing that is out of all proportion to really the risks that the monarchy is running by 1918 when, as a victorious state at the end of the war, it's really quite secure.
You mentioned earlier that the two princes, Edward and Albert, who were later Edward VIII and George VI, both served during the war. What were their experiences like?
If one looks at the war experience of the future George VI, who is at the time Prince Albert, second son of the royal couple, his war experiences are really quite difficult and, again, have not really received, from a kind of war historian point of view, have not really received adequate attention and exploration. He's quite ill during the war from a stomach ulcer, which continues to really disrupt his eating and, you know, really his difficulty sleeping. He's suffering a lot from anxiety as well. When one reads his symptoms, you get a sense of, you know, anxiety being a factor here too. And we know that's a factor. Stress is a factor in ulcers as well. And so for much of the war, he is dealing with this until they finally operate and finally resolve the problem while on board ship. So he goes to sea, he's in the Battle of Jutland. He writes quite a vivid account of being in the Battle of Jutland and what it's like to be there with explosions going on and being frightened that your ship will sink. And he performs quite bravely in that as well. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of his gathering up his courage to deal with what is a very, very stressful situation. You can see for someone who's quite a shy man, it doesn't come naturally to him to be in, you know, be surrounded by all of this, all of this war chaos and violence and really, you know, horror. I mean, there are many lives lost at Jutland. And that, you know, so I think if one looks at what the war does, it's almost a training experience for George VI to mask his feelings and to show strength of character, even when inside he's actually very afraid. And one of the things about his narratives and his accounts is you can read very clearly the fear. Yeah. And it's very much there. He doesn't put any bravado on it. He finds this war very frightening. So I think George VI has quite a difficult First World War. And in its aftermath, one of the things that comes out of it for him is this sense that actually the different class groups in Britain must be brought together. So he sets up these summer camps effectively for boys from public schools, from wealthy backgrounds, who will go to camps and spend weeks together with boys from working class backgrounds. And the prince himself attends some of those camps and really supports them in the 1920s. And that's a legacy of the war as well. This sense of treating everybody, that the monarchy must treat everybody equally, that there must be no distinction between how it treats people. And then, in fact, it must actually work to try and bring about reconciliation between the classes, that's in both the interest of the country, but also the interest of the monarchy itself as well, for stability and to avoid any potential Bolshevik revolution, which is their big fear and concern. If one looks at the future Edward VIII, the First World War is extremely formative for him as well. So one of the things about Edward VIII, before he goes away to the war, he's actually quite a sheltered young man. He has not really had any major life experiences. He's quite close to his parents. He spends a lot of time in the family unit. While he's away at war, and he actually he has to argue very strongly to be let go, because initially the Minister for War, Lord Kitchener, is afraid that if the Prince of Wales is captured by the Germans, it will damage British morale very badly, which again tells us about the status of the monarchy and that they're so worried about this. The future Edward VIII really lobbies to go, pushes to go. That becomes known. That helps to make him more popular again, because it shows that he's willing to serve like other boys his own age. He doesn't want to be left out. He doesn't want to be kept safely at home. And he goes as a staff officer. And he, you know, it really affects him that he is that all these people keep trying to protect him, while other young men his own age, many of them his friends, are charging into battle and are getting killed, are going through these horrific experiences, and he feels almost emasculated by it. And I think a lot of his later issues around his role as later Prince of Wales and King come from this sense that actually. These roles have somehow unmanned him. He hasn't been able to perform like a man on the battlefield, like all his peers. They have this battlefield experience and glamour, and he's been a staff officer. He hasn't been let go, experience battle. And that's one of the reasons why he keeps trying to go to the front and get into danger. It's partly about supporting the ordinary soldiers, which he cares really strongly about. But it's also about proving himself as a man, proving he can take shellfire. Proving he can take part in those stories in the mess afterwards, where all the infantry officers are sharing stories of what it's like to be in battle, and that he can kind of join in that as an equal is very important. And so this whole experience really forms him as someone who feels a bit less than, not really fully part of the growing up experience of his generation. And he does a lot of overcompensating for that. One of the other things is before the war, he's very inexperienced and shy around women. During the war in France, he starts visiting prostitutes, like many of his friendship group at the time. He falls in among some really quite rakish friends when he's on the Western Front. And that I think also long term really does damage him. He writes some very misogynistic things about women. He becomes very focused on trying to prove his success with women and mistresses as a way of showing again that he is a man like all the other men on the Western Front. And it's almost again a compensation for the fact he can't go into battle. So I think the war for the future Edward VIII is just actually incredibly damaging. Yes, it gives him contact with ordinary men and ordinary soldiers and makes him very popular with them because he does take lots of risks. But it also encourages him to take risks because risks can make you popular. That's a bad message to be taking forward into the 1920s and 1930s, when he really needs to sort of knuckle down and be responsible and actually focus on the formality of his role as future king.
In your recent feature that you wrote for BBC History magazine, you discussed how George V supported the formation of a West Indies regiment opposing the War Office, who didn't want black men serving as on the front. What was the reaction to this? And would that have made George seem like quite a progressive king?
It's quite interesting because, again, if we look at the formation of the West Indies Regiment, this is, again, one of these behind-the-scenes moments where royal influence is used to argue against the War Office position, and royal influence is a factor in why the regiment is formed and the War Office view does not win out. And a lot of this, the ways this works, this royal influence works, is very much through the private secretary, Lord Stanfordham, or the King's other private secretary, Clive Wigram, talking to certain people, making it known the King's views, pushing behind the scenes. So a lot of it's actually not written down. So it's quite difficult to pin down exactly what the general reaction was to this rebuff, basically, to the War Office position. But in terms of the king himself, King George V took his role as monarch as a kind of spiritual role. When we read about his coronation, he takes all of this as a religious person, as something that has been a role that God has bestowed on him that he must fulfill, and that he has an equal duty to all of his subjects. And so all of the subjects of the monarchy for George V and also for Queen Mary must be treated equally. They have an equal relationship with the king, who is, if you like, their guardian and their protector. It's a very paternalist system. And so this understanding is actually quite different to some of the views of, say, the colonial office or the war office, or indeed parts of government as well. And so I think that's where this move by George V comes from. He doesn't really see why one set of subjects should not be allowed to fight and another set of subjects should be. And so he himself actually has traveled to India, for example, and has Indian friends. Sir Pertab Singh is one of his close friends. He has Indian orderlies throughout the interwar period. He is not someone who is who is kind of creating a kind of stereotype of a sort of a whitewashed world. He really sees his empire, as he sees it. He sees it as his empire, as a place where all his subjects must have the same relationship with the monarchy, with the king, and that comes down also to the king's armies, where all of his subjects should have the same rights within the king's armies. He's dealing though with a system that doesn't necessarily see the world in those terms, even in those particularly, you know, strong kind of monarchist terms either. There's a lot more realpolitik in how government and the institutions of Whitehall see things. And their concern is to do particularly with the post-war and also with control of these colonial territories. And they also, for these colonial territories, they want to preserve in some cases what we would term a kind of white supremacy in some of these areas. And so that brings, you know, that explains that kind of clash between the War Office and the monarchy. The monarchy under George V, George V himself has a rather different vision of things. Now, some of his advisors are much closer to Whitehall's view around race than George V himself. So I wouldn't say it was a progressive reign, but I would say that the king himself has a very kind of Christian inflected view of a world that should maybe be one where subjects have greater equality than they have at that particular point in time. George V believes that as king, he treats everyone equally. He has this belief, whether it's entirely true, one could kind of look at maybe the honours lists and things and start to question that. But he has a belief that as king, he is relating to every subject in a very fair way.
Do we know what toll the war had on the royal family personally and emotionally?
The sources on this are quite interesting. So if one looks at a later conversation that the king has with Lloyd George in the 1930s, when he's a much older man, he's concerned about the rise of tensions in Europe. And it looks like there's going to be, you know, another war with the rise of Nazi Germany. And he actually says to Lloyd George, "I will go down to Trafalgar Square and wave the red flag myself rather than see this country go into another war." So I think the toll there, that outburst, which really shocks Lloyd George, he's, you know, not expecting this at all from what is a very anti-Bolshevik monarch. There's just this sense of, we cannot do this again. And I think that shows the emotional exhaustion that George V has been through. If we look at Queen Mary around the time of the abdication crisis, it's very clear that she feels very angry that her eldest son is not recognising that many families in the country had to sacrifice the lives of their sons for, as she saw it, for the monarchy and for Britain. and he cannot sacrifice a woman. So she is making that equation between, giving up happiness and love with actually giving up your life for your country, which is what people have done for the monarchy. And she finds that very, very hard. And I think that legacy again of that sense for both King George V and Queen Mary, that so many people have died for them, for king and country, that they must now live this kind of immaculate monarchical life. They must produce this very supportive monarchy that brings the country together, that helps to soothe and navigate and promote promote a better Britain as a result of the war, and make good the war's sacrifices. And that really dominates their thinking, and it's a terribly heavy burden to carry. The king at an emotional level talks to a lady at court at one point, saying, "You can't imagine what I suffered going around those hospitals during the war." And one sees in the sources from the war just what he's actually seeing and engaging with. I mean, they see many dying men. They are at the bedside of many dying men. They see that, you know, Queen Mary writes in her diary, you know, that she'd visited a hospital in London after an air raid on the East End, and she'd seen people who wounded or singed and burned by the bombing. And she talks about seeing a boy who dies in a Zeppelin raid, and she sees him dying with shrapnel in his lungs. I mean, they're seeing horrific, horrific things. And Princess Mary, too, who's only a teenager, going around on these hospital visits. And the king and the Western Front sees men dying of poison gas in hospital. This obviously would have had an effect. And at one point, the king writes to Queen Mary, "If it wasn't for you, I would break down during the war." So we get this sense of how terrible emotionally the effort is to keep the facade going of smiling and doing your duty and seeing all these dreadful things. And this is an era without counsellors, without them being able to really sit down and let it and have therapy or anything afterwards. I mean, they carry it for the rest of their lives. And I think the two things that help them to cope are really religion and in the case of the Prince of Wales, Edward VIII, a sort of sense of trying to promote European peace, which is a factor ultimately in some of his turning to appeasement as well. So it's quite an interesting idea of how can they make the future better to redeem the cost of the war, which I think all of the royals grapple with a bit afterwards. You can also see the impact in how they age. So if you look at the photographs of George V and the footage, by the end of the war, he's lost an awful lot of his hair. At the back of his head, it's hidden usually by a cap. He's gone grey. He's utterly haggard in terms of how many wrinkles in the state of his skin and his face by the end of the war. He actually dies quite young as well. So I think that stress, that strain is very visible in their bodies. Queen Mary, she starts to suffer a pain in her arm from all of the shaking of hands and continues doing that. They're middle-aged when the war starts. I mean, they have teenage children and children in their 20s. They're not young. And the war really does, have an impact on them, both emotionally and physically. It's a really extreme experience to have gone through in the roles that they were in at the time.
How do you think their response during the First World War influenced that of the monarchy during the Second World War?
Well, I think the two world wars are quite different in some ways. So I don't want to make kind of easy comparisons between them. I think by the Second World War, you've had the abdication crisis, which has really shattered the mystique, particularly the religious aura around the monarchy. And it's also a very different world. We've had the 30s and during the 30s, you do have the rise of this kind of idea of war as futile, the First World War as having been unnecessary for Britain, lives as having been wasted. That's when Wilfred Owen's poetry becomes popular, even though it's actually published a good bit earlier. And this is the phase where you see, you see figures like Sassoon, all of those becoming the key voices on the war. And so by the time you get to the Second World War, Britain's mobilisation is really different. There isn't a sense of the kind of Edwardian romance around war at all by 1939. And in fact, the new king, he's only been in the role since 1936. He's not very well known as a person yet. And that is one parallel with his father, who'd only just come to the throne as well before the First World War. He's a shy man. George V is not shy, and if we look at George VI, he is a shy man. He has a stammer. It is harder for him to make himself known, to kind of create a royal image at the start of World War II. That said, where he does really, I think, have his first really dramatic impact in the war is when he makes a speech about standing at the gate of the year. So he starts to work through radio, and that's an echo of, again, of what his father had done by bringing in the Christmas speech, which George V had initiated in the interwar period. So the Second World War, it's much more through radio that you start to see the royals trying to create that connection, and and newsreel footage much more. That in World War One, that was there, that was being used. One of the big war films is a film of George V at the front with his armies, the king with his armies at the front. But by World War Two, that's become much more important. And what's also really key is in World War Two, you have a leader, Winston Churchill, who does really overshadow the monarchy. In World War One, you have a leader, Lloyd George, who would have liked to, but who isn't able to. And I think that speaks to the very different ways in which monarchy operated and was seen in Britain before the abdication, when there was really this awe around it and this sense of kind of religiosity or sanctification around it. And World War Two, where a lot of that has changed. It's a new generation who are fighting this war. They're younger. They've got different ideas. They haven't been, they haven't grown up under Queen Victoria and kind of the Edwardian period. And so it's a very different situation. And the Second World War Prime Minister, even though he's very royalist, Winston Churchill, does overshadow the role of the king. Often we point to the moment where the King and Queen in the Second World War went to visit bombed out houses in the East End, and also the famous comment by Queen Elizabeth, who became the Queen Mother, about how now I can look the East End in the face. And she was really important in terms of trying to soften the image of George VI and give him a bigger profile and help him to become this kind of pivotal figure to the British war effort. And it's that image of kind of family life where we see the most important contribution of the British monarchy in the Second World War, because the British press and propaganda teams juxtaposed this image of a small royal family in the countryside, having, just cycling on their bicycles, they're playing with the corgis, two little girls and their mother and father, a very, very low key, very democratic image of monarchy as a family, as a small family unit. And they juxtaposed that with all the images that were coming out of fascist Europe of militarist display, militarist trappings, Adolf Hitler leading rallies of troops and of Hitler youth. And they were showing this family of four in civilian clothing, doing ordinary things. And that was where the royal family, in terms of imagery, was very important in sending out a message that Britain was not militaristic, it was not fascist, it was a democratic constitutional monarchy, it was a state where there wasn't bombast, there was quiet familial love, and that was a very deliberate propaganda message where particularly the queen at the time in the Second World War was very influential in really giving Britain this image of peaceable democracy. The other thing that's significant is when they did visit the East End, The crowds were not as huge as we see, for example, for the First World War surrounding monarchical visits. So that's also something to ponder. I think the Second World War, the monarchy is more important in terms of sending that image of Britain as a democracy and the royal family as a family unit, than it was in the First World War, when it was very much about symbolising a kind of a British, the trappings of a British state as such. That kind of there was much more pageantry still in terms of how the monarchy's sort of awe-inspiring image was used in World War One to kind of create this interaction with ordinary people as something that was kind of innovative and new. That's not so much there in the Second World War in the same way.
So my final question for you, in your opinion, why did the British monarchy survive the First World War when so many others didn't?
It's a very interesting question as to why the British monarchy survived the First World War when so many others didn't. I think there's sort of two key things that matter here in this case. The first is obviously victory. So countries that were defeated did a lot of soul searching about the nature of their state and why it had effectively failed in wartime. And in that type of explosive situation, anti-monarchism could really take hold. However, within that, when we do look at dynasties that were overthrown in the First World War, the anti-monarchism starts well before defeat. So there's something else here too, and this would be my second key thing. How a monarchy is handling the war, how they're behaving, is key in whether that anti-monarchism that starts in wartime and really explodes and develops into a mass movement or remains something at the fringes. And so in the British case, we see it remaining very much at the fringes in 1917, partly because of the way the royal family were so proactive in supporting the war effort, in denying themselves any kind of leisure luxury or food luxury or alcohol or anything. They were incredibly stringent on this. They really were living in almost kind of quite monk-like behavioural conditions. They really dropped all of the kind of normal trappings of court life. So that's how a monarchy behaves is a key factor in triggering that anti-monarchism to snowball during the war and to become something that can then drive revolution and feed into revolution, which then, if defeat happens, is utterly explosive and destroys a monarchy. And if we look at the monarchies that are overthrown, if you look at, say, for example, the Kaiser's court, they're still serving caviar. If we look at whether the women of the court are visiting hospitals, they're not. If we look at the Kaiser himself, he doesn't go into areas of danger at the front. He stays very much in the rear zone and actually spends a lot of the war in a castle back in Germany. And so there is this sense that maybe the German monarchy isn't enduring and suffering with its people in the same way. And key to that is the German equivalent of the Prince of Wales, the Crown Prince, who's actually building this magnificent palace, the Cecilienhof, outside of Berlin at Potsdam during the war, really almost tone deaf to the fact that many Germans are now starving from the Allied blockade of Germany. And he's building this luxurious palace. It's still there. You can visit it today. It's where the Potsdam Conference happens at the end of the Second World War. And it seems remarkable that they would be worrying about this type of flamboyantly decorated palace. One room's decorated to be like a magnificent ship's cabin. During the end of a calamitous total war when their people are hungry. So I think how a monarchy behaves is key as well. And that's the bit that's been forgotten. It's been quite easy to say, oh, well, victorious countries, their monarchies were obviously going to be more stable than defeated ones. But actually, there's more to it than that. And where we see monarchies survive, but also then thrive, is in how they behave during the war. And then the other really key factor is how they treat the war dead, how they behave towards the war dead. And here, the British monarchy is a little bit special. Very early on, it realises the need to reach out to the war bereaved, through sending official letters, condolence letters, and obviously attending things like the burial of the unknown soldier, which sees the king act as the chief mourner for an unknown soldier who could be of any class, race, or rank, or creed, who is buried in Westminster Abbey. And that's very symbolic, the idea that monarchy is going to mourn on behalf of the nation at the feet, at the grave of an unknown person who could be anyone from Britain or its empire, and that is a kind of openness to channeling grief, and the British monarchy is very successful in ultimately becoming the kind of the guardian, the custodian of commemorative need of people to grieve the war dead. And you see that as another kind of further factor that really, I think, really does help to protect it in an era of revolution. And the contrast here is Ireland, because if we look at Ireland, there is a very strong anti-monarchism that gets off the ground in Ireland, that snowballs and that becomes quite extreme. And you don't see a mass anti-monarchism in Britain in the same way at all. When you look for it during the war amongst ordinary people, it just isn't there. There isn't, people aren't toppling statues of royals around Britain during the First World War the way that is happening in Ireland. People are not, they don't have to travel with heavy security in Britain. The Prince of Wales can go unaccompanied to Parliament in London. This is not, in the Irish case, this couldn't happen. So we do see what real anti-monarchism would look like, and it's not there. The British monarchy is very secure in many ways in 1918 compared to other monarchies across Europe and compared to, say, the anti-monarchism that develops in Ireland.
That was Heather Jones. Her book, For King and Country, The British Monarchy and the First World War, is out now, published by Cambridge University Press. Heather has written a feature on the Royals at War, which appears in the October issue of BBC History magazine. That's on sale now and also includes features on the surprisingly modern Middle Ages, the long shadow of 9/11, and Tudors in love. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley. Tune in tomorrow when Francis Pryor will be speaking about prehistoric life.